It doesn't have to be a proper name if it's put in the category of belief. Remember this. Win at Scrabble. The Monothelites argued that although Christ has two natures, which the church had said was the official view, yet since he's a single person, he has only one will. Reminds me of the story of the guy and his wife that got in a fight about how the rope had been cut that caused the bucket and the well to be found on the bottom. Remember that? The husband said it had been cut with a knife. And the wife said it had been cut with scissors. And they got in a terrible fight. And the husband got so mad, he said it's cut with a knife, and he grabbed his wife and threw her down the well. And the last he saw as she's going down the darkness, she's going like this. These Monophysites are still going like this. If they can't have two natures, they're going to semantically still win by saying he has only one will. If he has two natures and they can't have monophysite, just one nature, they'll say one will. This council was to settle that issue, replying that if he has two natures, he must also have two wills. So the Monothelites, which was but a further refinement of monophysitism or a last going down the well argument, get the same verdict that the Monophysites got. Both the Monophysites and the Monothelites, the one nature people and the one will people, are ruled heresy. And vast sections of the church are cut off from communion with the rest of the church because they were such diehards, their bishops so hard-headed, they wouldn't accept it. Now, when the Muslims moved on the scene, breaking the emperor's rule in Persia and Egypt, then the power of Rome East, Constantinople, to force the belief was gone, and with the wedge of the Islamic faith having moved in, the Monophysites and the Monothelites could retain their beliefs under the Muslims easier than they could retain it under Roman rule. So this whole section of the church is cut off. During the 50 years before the meeting of the Sixth Council, Byzantium was faced with a sudden alarming development, the rise of Islam. The most striking fact about Mohammedan expansion is its speed. When the prophet died in 632, his authority scarcely extended beyond Hejaz, but within 15 years, his Arab followers had taken Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. Within 50 years, they were at the walls of Constantinople and almost captured the city. Within 100, they had swept across North Africa, advanced through Spain, and forced Western Europe to fight for its life. It was a centrifugal explosion. The old empire was in no state to resist them, and Christendom survived, but only with difficulty. The Byzantines lost their eastern possessions, and the three patriarchates of Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem passed under Muslim control. Within the Christian Empire of the East, the Patriarchate of Constantinople was now without a rival. And Constantinople, of all those Eastern patriarchs, was the only one still within the Western Empire, and thus within the official religion of the empire dominated by Rome. Disputes concerning the person of Christ did not cease with the Council of 681. Were extended in different form into the 8th and 9th centuries. The struggle centered on the holy icons. And here we didn't spend as much time. I'm going to spend a little more time now and we'll be done with the seven major councils. Nicaea settled the nature of Christ being one with the Father. The next one elevates the Holy Spirit. Then they begin to concentrate on these other arguments, ultimately separating Nestorius, who argued Mother of God, no, Mother of Christ, yes. Then the arguments over one person or two natures, rather, one nature or two natures. Finally, with the official view being Two natures. Okay, two natures, but one will. No, big fight. Official position. Not only two natures, two wills. And we're through six councils. And well into 400 years of fighting. Now the struggle centers on holy icons, the pictures of Christ, the Mother of God, and the saints, which were kept and venerated both in churches and in private homes. Am I boring you? The iconoclasts or icon smashers, suspicious of any religious art which represented human beings or God, demanded the destruction of icons. The opposite party, the icon worshippers, or venerators of icons, vigorously defended the place of icons in the life of the church. I can tell you right now, they're worth a lot of money. Spiritual or not, I'll take all the icons I can get. In fact, Jews and Christians fleeing persecution have carried icons like they carry diamonds, as things of great value, monetarily as well as spiritually. That's another subject. The struggle was not merely a conflict between two conceptions of Christian art. Deeper issues were involved. The character of Christ's human nature, the Christian attitude toward matter, the relationship to Christian redemption that these icons were said to have. The iconoclasts may have been influenced from the outside by the Jewish and Muslim ideas. And it is significant that 3 years before the first outbreak of iconoclasm in the Byzantine Empire, the Mohammedan Caliph Yazid ordered the removal of all icons within his dominions. But iconoclasm was not simply imported from outside. Within Christianity itself, there had always existed a Puritan outlook which condemned icons because it saw in all images a latent idolatry. Typical of this Puritan outlook is the action of Saint Epiphanius of Salamis, who, on finding in a Palestinian village church a curtain woven with the figure of Christ, tore it down with indignation, and that was as early as the end of the 4th and the start of the 5th century. This attitude toward images was always strong in Asia Minor. And to some extent, the iconoclast movement was an Asiatic protest against Greek tradition. Two leading iconoclast emperors, Leo III and Leo V, were of Asiatic origin. Here we go again. The Eastern Church against the Western Church, taking the form of a fight over icons. The iconoclast controversy, which lasted some 120 years. Now, they had fought all these years, centuries, over homoousion, theotokos, monophysitism, monothelitism, having wore themselves out on that one. Now, icons for 120 years. Where's faith and grace and peace? The first period opened in 726 when Leo III, and again we see these great councils were more dominated by the position the state took than by any revelation from God. The first period opened in 726 when Leo III began his attack on icons. Ended in 780 when the Empress Irene suspended the persecution. The iconodule position was upheld with a seventh and last. There's another one for Scrabble. The iconodule position. The iconodule position was upheld with a seventh and last ecumenical council, 787, which met as the first had done. Now we're at 787, and it met over this matter at Nicaea. Icons, the council proclaimed, are to be kept in churches and honored with the same relative veneration as is shown to other material symbols such as the precious and life-giving cross and the book of the Gospels. Now, these fundamentalists that believe all these great doctrines that were worked out, not with Paul's book to the Galatians held open, but by these infighting political bishoprics, also said that icons are to receive the same veneration shown to other material symbols of Christianity, such as the precious and life-giving cross and the book of the Gospels. Then you don't tear a church down, a holy site. You're a true fundamentalist. A new attack on icons started by Leo V of Armenia in 815, continued until 843 when the icons were again reinstated. This time permanently by another empress, Theodora. The final victory of the holy images in 843 is known as the Triumph of Orthodoxy. Now, church history refers to the Triumph of Orthodoxy, when the church upheld the position of the veneration of holy images. And not only is it known as the Triumph of Orthodoxy, it's commemorated in a special service celebrated on Orthodox Sunday, the first Sunday in Lent. So now when you see in a religious calendar Orthodox Sunday, you know what it is commemorating. First Sunday of Lent. During this service, the true faith, orthodoxy, is proclaimed. Its defenders are honored and anathemas are pronounced on all who attack the holy icons or the seven general councils. And this is the anathema that is proclaimed. Quote, "To those who reject the counsels of the holy fathers and their traditions which are agreeable to divine revelation and which the Orthodox Catholic Church piously maintains, anathema, anathema, anathema." The chief champion of the icons in the first period was St. John of Damascus, who lived from 675 to 749. In the second period, St. Theodore of Studium, who lived from 759 to 826. John was able to work the more freely because he dwelt in Muslim territory out of the reach of the Byzantine government. It was not the last time that Islam acted unintentionally as the protector of orthodoxy. One of the distinctive features of orthodoxy is the place to which it assigns icons. An orthodox church today is filled with them. Dividing the sanctuary from the body of the building, there is a solid screen, the iconostasis, entirely covered with icons, while other icons are placed in special shrines around the church. And perhaps the walls are covered with icons in fresco or mosaic. An Orthodox prostrates himself before these icons. He kisses them and burns candles in front of them. They're censed by the priest and carried in procession. What do these gestures and actions mean? What do icons signify, and why did John of Damascus and others regard them as important? Well, first, consider the charge of idolatry, which the iconoclast brought against the iconodules. Then the positive value of icons as a mean of instructions, and finally their doctrinal importance. These are the three things that the councils decided. On the question of idolatry, when an Orthodox kisses an icon or prostrates himself before it, he is not guilty of idolatry. The icon is not an idol, but a symbol. The veneration shown to images is directed not toward stone, wood, and paint, but toward the person depicted. This had been pointed out some time before the iconoclast controversy by Leontius of Neapolis. Quote, "We do not make obeisance to the nature of wood, but we revere and do obeisance to him who was crucified on the cross. When the two beams of the cross are joined together, I adore the figure because of Christ who on the cross was crucified. But if the beams are separated, I throw them away and burn them. Because icons are only symbols, Orthodox do not worship them, but reverence or venerate them. John of Damascus carefully distinguished between the relative honor or veneration shown to material symbols and the worship due to God alone. Now, fundamentalists locally are saying, the church is a people. Well, that's true. But God has also utilized places and things as symbols. To use Oral Roberts' word, one of the few real positive contributions he's made to theology, point of contact as a foci of attention to surfboard to a worship of God. Sure, the church is a people, but when God has met people at a particular place consistently, that place or that thing can be used as a symbol as words can be used as a symbol to direct attention to the object of true worship. In that sense, the church was right on the icons. Icons as part of the church's teaching, second premise. Icons, said Leontius, are opened books to remind us of God. They're one of the means which the church employs in order to teach the faith. He who lacks learning or leisure to study works of theology has only to enter a church to see unfolded before him on the walls all the mysteries of the Christian religion. If a pagan asks you to show him your face, said John of Damascus, take him to a church and place him before the icons. Probably carried too far, but in principle true. That's why people take trips to the Holy Land. They don't see Jesus on the Mount of Beatitudes. They see rocks, a monastery that kind of destroys what it was when Jesus was there, looking over the Sea of Galilee. You can sit down on a rock and it becomes a point of contact to enrich. I remember having a group in that little natural cathedral that comes from the curve of the hill above Galilee, and teaching on the lessons that Jesus proclaimed in the Sermon on the Mount. And I think it took root with the power and probably stayed in the memory of the people in a way that never would have stayed there. Just teaching the same truth in a storefront church on some street in a city in the United States. They become waves of symbolic focus that the mind can surfboard on and lift itself to the higher truths. 3, the doctrinal significance of icons. Here we come to the real heart of the iconoclast dispute. Granted that icons are not idolatrous, granted that they're useful for instruction, but are they not only permissible, but necessary? Is it essential to have icons? The iconodules held that it is, because icons, they say, safeguard a full and proper doctrine of the Incarnation. Iconoclasts and iconodules agree that God cannot be represented in his eternal nature. No man has seen God at any time. But the iconodules, those who believe in icons, continued, the Incarnation has made a representational religious art possible. God can be depicted because he became man and took flesh. Now, they got an argument. Before Christ, the order was, make no images. But the doctrine of the Incarnation says that God's substance of life, invisible in nature, struck a tent and human flesh And God made a representational image. And after God made that representational image, by His authority of having so revealed His nature, not all of it, but the part He wanted to reveal in Christ in the tent of human flesh, where He humbled Himself and took upon Himself the form of a servant, then representation of that form stands in a dimension after the fact of God so doing it, different from the earlier commands against it. Because you have a proof coin struck. Now, you who collect coins know the difference between a proof coin and other coins. But once the proof coin is struck, other coins have a point of reference to the proof. And the iconodules held that icons are necessary because they safeguard a full and proper doctrine of the Incarnation. The Incarnation, the iconodules said, has made a representational religious art possible. God can be depicted because He became man and took flesh. Material images, argued John of Damascus, can be made of Him who took a material body. Of old God, quote, the incorporeal and uncircumscribed was not depicted at all. But now that God has appeared in the flesh and lived among men, John said, I can make an image of the God who can be seen. I do not worship matter, but I worship the Creator of matter, who for my sake became matter and deigned to dwell in matter, who through matter effected my salvation, and I will not cease from worshiping the matter through which my salvation has been effected, namely the matter which is Jesus the Christ. Isn't it amazing how you can grow up in a tradition that, it's like the Baptists who used to say the Pentecostals speak in tongues because the devil does it through them. Now they have to be silent on that, keep it to themselves, because they go to the National Association of Evangelicals, and Tom Zimmerman, the head of the Assemblies of God, Pentecostals, is too powerful to let them get away with that anymore. Church doesn't change much. I'm boring you, I know. I'm going to finish whether you like it or not. The iconoclast, by repudiating all representations of God, failed to take full account of the Incarnation. They fell, as so many Puritans have done, into a kind of dualism. Regarding matter as a defilement, they want a religion freed from all contact with what is material, for they thought that what is spiritual must be non-material. This is to betray the Incarnation by allowing no place to Christ's humanity, to His body. It is to forget that man's body as well as his soul are involved in the Incarnation. The iconoclast controversy was thus linked closely to the earlier disputes about Christ's person. It was not merely a controversy about religious art, but about the Incarnation itself. Icons, for example, in the words of the Russian Orthodox leader Nicholas Zernoff, icons were for the Russians not merely paintings. They were dynamic manifestations of man's spiritual power to redeem creation through beauty and art. And as John of Damascus put it, the icon is a song of triumph and a revelation and an enduring monument to the victory of the saints and the disgrace of the demons. The conclusion of the iconoclast dispute, the meeting of the Seventh Ecumenical Council, the triumph of Orthodoxy in 843, these mark the end of the second period of Orthodox history, the period of the seven councils. And so you know the difference between Rome and the Orthodox Church. These seven councils are of immense importance to Orthodoxy. For members of the Orthodox Church, their interest is not merely historical, but contemporary. They are the concern not only of scholars and clergy, but of all the faithful. Even illiterate peasants, said Dean Stanley, to whom in the corresponding class of life in Spain or Italy the names of Constance and Trent would probably be quite unknown, are well aware that their church reposes on the basis of the seven councils and retain a hope that they may yet live to see an eighth council in which the evils of the time will be set straight. And they live They've never had a reformation. They live for a reconciliation in which the Roman or Western church will agree to a meeting of all the churches as equals, not with Rome being supreme. Rome can have primacy, but not supremacy. And if Rome would ever humble itself from its claim of supremacy, it would be honored with primacy, even allowed to preside in an eighth general council of the church that could, for today, right the evils of the world with the right view of God. That's their view, as the seven councils did for their day. Orthodoxy often call themselves the Church of the Seven Councils. By this, they do not mean that the Orthodox Church has ceased to think creatively since 787, but they see in the period of the councils the great age of theology, and next to the Bible, it is the seven councils which the Orthodox Church takes as its standard and guide in seeking solutions to the new problems which arise in every generation. And Western Christianity had better understand the position of the Orthodox Church, if not the position of the Nestorians and the position of the Monophysites and Monothelites, if there's ever to become an ecumenical union in the world. Somebody's going to bring that together one day. There'll probably be a voice that unites a false church under a false prophet, who probably in some great eighth council will find it is the will of God for the church to take the mark of the beast. For Jerry Falwell might think he is the prophet of the world, but he's really a little peanut. The church is much bigger than Charlotte, North Carolina, or Lynchburg, Virginia. When the histories of the world are read by those who live in a new heaven and a new earth, I doubt that Lynchburg or Charlotte will even get a footnote. So keep your head above the dust. The church will survive. Tragically, the false church will too. But the church has always had this problem, and the true church has to somehow come out from underneath all this crap and return to the simple good news of the gospel and the dynamite of salvation, which is the message of Paul. And with that summation, I think I'm ready now to go back to the first century when we return to church history. You understand a lot more than you thought you would, didn't you? Amazing how much we picked up as we waded through these councils. I'm not impressed with their spirituality. If you learn anything, get on the phone. Oh, I know. You want me to return to this book. Communion. If I'd been afraid before, I now became quite simply crazed with terror. I argued with them. That's just to let you know, I know where I left off.